This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby in for Virginia Prescott. For most modern pet owners, dogs represent companionship, loyalty, and love. But throughout history, man's best friend has also been associated with our conceptions of death. You've probably seen images of Anubis, the jackal-headed Egyptian god of embalming and funerals, or heard of Cerberus, the three-headed hound that guarded the gates of hell in Greek mythology. Fast forward to today, where cadaver dogs are specially trained to locate human remains. Kat Warren is a professor at North Carolina State University, where she teaches science, journalism, and creative nonfiction. She's also a cadaver dog handler, and her new book is called What the Dog Knows. And Kat, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Taylor. It's really delightful.
Of course. So I mentioned Anubis in the introduction, but we were really stunned to find that dogs weren't just symbols. You write that the Zoroastrians actually used dogs in their funerary rites. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I mean, the Zoroastrians are a kind of interesting case because very early on, they integrated dogs into almost every aspect of their lives. And so, you know, they had the herding dogs. They had something called house dogs, which were kind of the equivalent of our lap dogs. And then they had these dogs called sogdid. And what the sogdid dog did was that it drove away the demons that might otherwise inhabit people's bodies, and which was a great fear. And what the Zoroastrians realized is that dogs could be around dead bodies and even, let's say, eat dead bodies without these demon gods coming after them. And so there was that kind of like, well, let's take advantage of this. And so they created these dogs that were specifically brought in to stand by the corpse and gaze on it and drive away the demons that might otherwise inhabit that loved one.
Were these special breeds of dogs? Were they specific colors? What set them apart?
An archaeologist sent me a beautiful little bronze figurine of what they thought a sogdid dog was, and it looked exactly like a German Shepherd, which pleased me utterly because, since I have two of them. But one of the things that they had to be was reasonably young male, and then that they would have quote-unquote four eyes. And what they meant by that is that these are the dogs that had little color patches above their eyes.
Oh, like little spots.
Little spots. And, you know, many of the herding breeds are, if you think about shepherds or even Rottweilers or other kinds of dogs, you know that those two-tone dogs are very often either in working or herding breeds. And those were the rules for these dogs that would come in and essentially protect corpses.
What is it about guarding the dead that people associate with a dog? Why a dog and why not some other type of animal?
Well, you know, it's so interesting to go back to the history of the dog, but we do know that early on, dogs were used to help dispose of bodies because dogs would eat people. And so when you had early civilizations and you would put the dead outside the gates of a city, for instance, the dogs would help take care of that. And it's that notion that if dogs can do this and not suffer from it, then they must have special powers. You know,
you mean because so many other animals, or because humans, of course, would get terribly sick and
Exactly. And, you know, humans had so much fear around death, and to see the kind of impunity with which dogs enjoyed themselves around corpses, it was like, let's turn what could be considered a negative into a positive.
Well, you did mention that you have two German Shepherds, is that right?
I do.
Two German Shepherds. And I know from the book that one of them is a cadaver dog, but I guess I was surprised to find that you sort of fell into being a cadaver dog handler. It's not something that you necessarily planned on. Can you talk a little bit about what led you to train your German Shepherd to become a cadaver dog?
Yeah, because as one trainer said, he was a jackass. We had this a technical term. We had a German Shepherd pup, and I was expecting my husband had fallen in love with shepherds, and we were expecting a pretty quiet, low key, obedient loyal dog. And Solo was several of those things, but he was also really a little hellion. He was a singleton, which meant that he had been the only pup in his litter. Mm-hmm. And that meant that he was essentially emotionally stunted around other dogs. He could not sort of read their language. And that's the way dogs get in trouble. So a lot of singletons happen to be dog aggressive. And Solo was, as a pup. We were just at the end of our ropes, and I took him to a trainer whom I respected greatly. And it was she who said, "Why don't you make him into a cadaver dog?" And so that's what happened. By the time he was two, I started training, was invited to train with a local police canine unit by their sergeant, with whom I still train today. And
let's talk a little bit about the work and about the training. I mean, how does one train a cadaver dog, especially I sort of think about what you said earlier. How does one prevent it from eating what it discovers? I mean, that's morbid.
Well,
but
you know, it's morbid, but it's realistic. I mean, let's face it, humans are mammals, and we all know the delight with which some dogs go out in the woods and find a dead deer or a dead squirrel.
Sure, and we wouldn't we wouldn't be surprised if
And we wouldn't be that shocked. I mean, we might be a little repulsed from the smell whatever, but it's sort of like, yeah. And so you train them essentially by distracting them. If there are dogs that have a tendency to say, "Oh gosh, this smells good." Solo is not one of those dogs, but what you're immediately doing is getting them more interested in their toy, or even for some dogs, a liver treat. And that sense of, "I really want to consume this," goes away very fast.
So what else goes into the training of a cadaver dog?
So one of the things that you have to do early on is teach the dog what that scent is. And what's interesting about cadaver scent is we still don't know a lot about it. We know that it's one of the most complex scents other than live human scent. Arpad Voss, who's a forensic anthropologist, has identified 480 different volatile compounds coming off of decomposing human bodies. And so that's a lot. I know. He thinks that once his DOA, which stands for Decomposition Odor Analysis Database, is done, he thinks it'll be closer to 1,000 compounds. And so what you're doing is you're telling the dog that all of these different scents and various combinations of them all are the thing they're looking for.
I'm speaking with Kat Warren. She's a professor at North Carolina State University, where she teaches science journalism and creative nonfiction. Her new book is What the Dog Knows, and she's also a cadaver dog handler. Her dog Solo just retired after 9 years as a cadaver dog. Now, do cadaver dogs need to have like especially good noses? I mean, are they known for being able to sniff out anything?
Lots of dogs have very good noses, and cadaver dogs have very good noses. It's not really relevant what the breed is. What you want is a dog that wants to work, has the ability to sort of ignore lots of distractions. Some of that happens in training. And then just like you can train a drug dog to find different kinds of narcotics, you can train a cadaver dog to find different stages that humans can go through as they decompose. So as you can well imagine, you might have somebody who is very recently missing, up to really ancient bones. We have evidence that dogs have been very good at helping locate bones from the old Mississippi Delta civilizations, the Mound people.
But I typically think of bloodhounds as being a dog that's really used to sniff out. You know, it's I guess maybe it's a movie trope, but you know, you show them a piece of fabric and they can trace anything and anybody to any location. But it doesn't seem like bloodhounds would be the go-to cadaver dog.
Well, the process is a little different. With a tracking or trailing dog, it's that classic trope, as you said, where you show them something to sniff that belonged to that person and then tell them to go find that person, and they're following the trail of that person. With cadaver dogs or with drug dogs, what those dogs are doing is they're trying to find in the air a scent. So they're basically quartering back and forth to find that scent. And you'll also see that if you see dogs working on a disaster scene, right, they're not following a trail. They're going up on that rubble and they're trying to find a hint of live human and in some cases dead human. And so they're simply going around these rubble piles looking for that scent because there's nothing to track. So once they hit that scent, what they're going to do is they're going to go down to where that scent is most concentrated. And ideally, you'll have a live victim who can be saved by that.
Right.
Sadly, in some cases, it also helps find somebody who's deceased.
You know, I think it would be obvious to anybody that a human being working in those sorts of conditions is going to be liable to feel some trauma, you know, that there can be some real emotional distress associated with that kind of rescue operation. Do you know at all if dogs, if rescue dogs or cadaver dogs feel the sort of weight of those situations?
So it's a complicated answer. Mm. In principle, no, because if you have a cadaver dog, you are training them to feel utter joy when they find the dead because they're going to get the reward that they're waiting
right,
for.
The toy right? or the treat, yeah.
That, exactly. So a well-trained dog does not say, oh my God, I've just found somebody dead. This is so upsetting. That said, if you have a dog that we call a live find dog and it's put into a situation, and this certainly happened in 9/11, where they're not finding live victims, it can be upsetting for the handler and for the dog. So some of the discussion that came about saying that the dogs got depressed when they found somebody who was dead, it wasn't so much that. It was that dogs were being used in situations where it just wasn't in their training to be finding what they found.
You know, we think of these dogs that do work, whether it's finding cadavers or other types of service. You know, we think about it a lot of times in terms of the benefit that it provides to us. But I wonder, you know, does it provide a benefit to the dog? Did Solo really benefit from his life as a cadaver dog?
You know, I could ask him, and I don't know what he would say.
He's not there in the studio with you, is he?
You know, he's not in the studio. He loved training. He loved going on searches. And I think that several things happened. First of all, it opened up a world to him that might have been more narrow given his issues with other dogs if I hadn't discovered this work. But it gave him enormous freedom and a lot of area to stretch his legs and his brain, right? The other thing it did is that there's some evidence that working dogs actually have longer and healthier lives. There's some early research that people are starting to do, like Cindy Otto down up at Penn, about the fact that working dogs are pretty happy dogs. They're very physically fit. They are, for the most part, not obese. And they get out a lot, and they get to think and work. And for many dogs, that's a pretty happy thing.
Well, Kat, thank you so much for joining us today. It was really, really fascinating.
Oh, thank you so much. I really appreciate being invited.
Kat Warren is a professor at North Carolina State University, where she teaches science journalism and creative nonfiction. Her book, What the Dog Knows, is now out in paperback. And you can find a link to more information at our website, wordofmouthradio.org.